Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, we're talking music with Kevin Kuzma, drummer and driving force behind the legendary New Jersey Thrashers, Blood Feast, on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight we're talking music. We have with us the man behind one of the wildest and most aggressive U.S.-based thrash acts, with a sound derived in equal parts from Exodus and Slayer and the German school, Creator, Destruction, Sodom, Exhumer. Blood Feast were hands down the most well-recognized and best-selling act on the classic New Renaissance Records roster. With two incredibly vicious releases, Kill for Pleasure and the EP Face Fate, they staked their claim in underground metal circles, drawing attention worldwide for the wild assault on the ears they were known for delivering. After putting out one more polished, Bay Area-oriented album with Chopping Block Blues, Blood Feast disbanded for nearly 20 years. Now back together with original guitarist Adam Tranquilli, Kevin has reformed Blood Feast and is currently touring with eyes towards a new album. Join us for an in-depth discussion with Kevin Kuzma, only here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we'll be talking about the band's formation, their name change from Bloodlust, East Coast style, and being underground. But first, just to give you an idea what we're referring to, here's Blood Feast with the Face Fate version of Bloodlust.
Thank you.
Tonight, we're talking music. We have with us now a man who is the driving force behind a band who were hands down the most well-known and reportedly the best-selling act in the new Renaissance Records label roster. With two incredibly vicious releases, Kill for Pleasure and the EP Face Fate, they made their name in underground metal circles, drawing attention worldwide for the wild assault in the years they were known for delivering. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to bring you Kevin Kuzma, drummer for Blood Feast. Kevin, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
What's up, man? How's it going? Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, no relation to Nora Louise Kuzma, right?
No, not at all.
I figured you'd know who that was. Let's go back to the start. You were there at the beginning of the band with bassist Luis Thurita. Even before you got together with the rest of the guys, the two of you were out there laying down the bottom end with other bands. So how did you guys get together?
Well, let's see. From what I can remember, because it's been quite some time. No, actually, I met Louis in high school. I was playing in a band with some other people. They told me that there was this guy who was looking to play with some people, same style of music, because it was kind of like far and few between that you could actually find people who were into the same stuff.
Right.
You know, because the music was so underground at that point, you know.
I remember.
I mean, it wasn't like today where everybody knows who, you know, Slayer is and Exodus is and Celtic Frost and all this other stuff. I mean, back then it was, you know, that stuff was just unheard of by a lot of people.
And so anyway, people didn't know, were scared.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it was truly real underground music. I mean, I'm going to say it's still underground today, obviously, just because it's not, you know,
mainstream,
not commercial.
Right.
But, yeah, it's not mainstream. I mean, this music will always be underground. But, of course, you know, just like I said, starting back in the early days, it was even more underground than it was today. So, anyway, me and him were in the same high school, and I approached him one day on the bus ride home, and I said, hey, man, you know, people tell me you're a bass player and I'm a drummer. I said, maybe we should hook up. I heard you like the same kind of stuff. We did. We put a ad out in a local music newspaper called The Aquarian, and we dropped an ad in there for a guitarist and a singer. I believe that we got Adam first. He was like one of the first people to reply, and we got Gary. And we also had actually another member of the band when we first started. His name was Kevin. I don't actually recall his last name. He was actually a guitar player also. We always wanted to have two guitar players in the band. As far back as I can remember, I know something didn't really work out too well with Kevin. He wound up leaving the band. We stuck as a four-piece. And we started jamming. I mean, we started jamming together, you know, obviously playing cover songs.
Right.
And then, right from there, we kind of just started, you know, rolling into originals and how we wanted to play and what kind of style we wanted to play and all that kind of stuff. So
right. That's
really how the band formed, you know. You know, before we put out Kill for Pleasure, we actually got Michael Bazin in the band because, again, we were always kind of looking for a second guitar player.
Right.
And right before we went into record, you know, we wound up getting him as a second guitar player. So it added a lot of, you know, we always thought that having two guitar players was good. You have another input for writing most of the time. I think it sounds way better live when you have two guitar players. You know, it sounds more powerful and stuff like that. So
you mentioned that you put an ad in the Aquarian. Was this before it turned to the East Coast Rocker, and then recently it turned back to, well, recently in the 90s, it turned back to the Aquarian?
Maybe at the time it was the East Coast Rocker. I don't remember. I mean, this is going back to like 80, 84, 85. So whatever fall during the 84, 85. I mean, I don't know. I know it as the Aquarian, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's how I always referred it with. Yeah,
sure.
That's how we actually got together, you know.
So originally, you went by the name Bloodlust, but you changed that to Blood Feast after the entertaining Herschel Gordon Lewis Gore film, which, intentionally or no, carries a little extra resonance and probably still gets you a bit more attention than you might have if you remained under the original moniker. So what prompted the change?
The biggest reason for the change was simply because when we had our demo out, you know, we pumped out like several hundred copies of the demo tape, and then all of a sudden we found out that there was this band Bloodlust out of California who I think were, I want to say that they were signed or getting signed, or we came to realize that there was another band called Bloodlust out there.
Right.
And instead of trying to fight with them and all this other kind of stuff, because we were in the real early stages of the band yet, we just decided that we're going to try to change the name.
Right.
We kind of wanted to not defer from the name all that much because we felt that we were making a name for ourselves under Bloodlust. So we came up with a just, you know, I remember sitting there writing down, you know, all of us took a pad and a pen and just wrote names that we were fond of. And each of us went down our list of names, and Blood Feast was one of them. And like I said, it wasn't too distant from Bloodlust, you know.
Right.
People were able to blood in it. Like you said, it had to do with the movie, which we thought was a plus. You know, it might ring a bell to a lot of people's ears rather than just the, you know, the Bloodlust. So that's what we went with, and that's how we decided to keep it.
So backtracking a step, you put out the Suicidal Mission demos, Bloodlust, and shortly thereafter, you got signed to New Renaissance Records. How did this come about, particularly in such short order? Because especially in those days, bands could have demo after demo kicking around before finally getting signed, if they even did get signed. You know, nowadays it seems a lot easier with all these little independents dotting the landscape and people self-releasing through the internet and iTunes. But at the time, you know, it really didn't work that fast. So how did that work out for you?
Well, you got to also remember, too, back in the day, there wasn't as many labels. I mean, nobody was really doing anything themselves like they are today.
Right.
You know, nobody was pressing. Back in the day, it was albums, actually, when all this happened. No bands were really pressing their own albums or anything like that. Yeah, I mean, it was easy to make a copy of a demo tape and reproduce it on your own. That's pretty much what we did. I mean,
right.
Shit, man, we colored in. We hand-colored in our logo, you know what I mean, on the demo tapes. I mean, it was crazy. But basically what happened was we were sending it out to a bunch of labels. I mean, again, at the time, there wasn't a ton of labels. I mean, you had Metal Blade.
Right.
I believe you had Roadrunner at the time. And then a lot of other labels were European labels, you know? I don't even remember how I got New Renaissance's name thrown at me. I must have been maybe, I know I had a bunch of contact information of record labels and stuff, and New Renaissance happened to be one of them. And we sent it out to everybody. New Renaissance was one of the first labels that actually replied to us and were like, hey, you know what? We do these compilation albums. Would like to take a song or two off your demo tape and put it on here. And we thought that was great because, I mean, it was exposure. I mean, obviously, having your music put onto an LP and having it distributed at that time was, I mean, that's all we want. That was a huge deal, you know? Like I said, you didn't have the access to do that like you have today.
Right.
So basically that was a big deal. And, of course, we figured, hey, you know what? A compilation, you get to show off a little bit on it. You're one of the bands that can maybe shine compared to the other bands that are on the LPs.
Right.
I mean, we didn't know who else was going to be on it. We just thought it was a good opportunity. And, unfortunately, it was really only one of the responses that we got. You know, so we just jumped at it. I mean, we didn't really sit around and wait too long. It wasn't like we sat back and were like, hey, maybe we should wait and see what happens and blah, 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 blah. We were just kind of like, look, we were just excited to get an offer, to get our music out there on a record and distributed. And that's what was important to us at the time. So we kind of jumped at that opportunity, you know.
Now, you guys are local Jersey boys right over here in Bayonne. Now, East Coast metal always seems to stand out for its particular aggression and lack of polish in a good sense. You know, it doesn't have any of that overly clean veneer Bay Area thrash. It's far more akin to German thrash like Creator, Destruction, Sodom. And Bloodfeast certainly exemplifies that approach. So how do you feel that growing up around here, being a band born and raised in the Tri-State area, influences your sound?
I don't really know if it's I can't really put my finger on that, you know. I mean, I just know that growing up in the area that I grew up in, I mean, the appeal was just towards heavier music. I mean, I really can't explain it. I can't really say that my upbringing or my surroundings, I think, made me want to listen to heavy music more than listening to, I don't know, you know, some pop music. I mean, I don't really know what influenced me. I mean, I can tell you that when I was younger, people around me influenced me on this kind of music, and for some reason, my ears just preferred that kind of music than listening to other kind of stuff. When I started playing, you know, that's when I really, really, really started getting into, like, the heavier stuff. I mean, you know, I can't pinpoint it. I know what you're saying. I agree with you. I think that the East Coast definitely has a more rougher death metal, thrash metal type of edge, however you want to define it, compared to the West Coast. Like you said, it's not as polished. It's not as clean. It's not as fancy with a lot of guitar leads and all that kind of stuff. It's a little bit more blue-collar, you know, bare bones and more aggressive type style thrash. I get it, but I don't know, man. I can't really put my finger on it. I don't know why that is. I just know that growing up, I used to love the heavier stuff. You're talking Bayer, Vanna, Metallica, you know, all the heavier, like a lot of European stuff. Destruction, I was a huge Destruction fan, you know, like that stuff was,
you know,
European stuff seemed to appeal to me more than the American stuff, so.
Same here. Because, I'm just thinking that, you know, being in this area and growing up in this area, if you compare it to people from other parts of the country, not always, but for the most part, when you meet them, they're always kind of like, you know, they're more laid back, they're more whatever. Whereas here, it's like really, you know, up and in your face and, you know, get the freak out of my way and, you know, the whole deal. So I'm wondering if that just kind of rubs off the whole New York attitude. And that's what makes it. You know.
I mean, I think that's definitely part of it for sure. I mean, I know, like I was telling you before the interview, I moved out to Western PA like about 3 years ago now, and I mean, I'll tell you, it's a world of difference. I mean, I get accused of being hyper over here, and I talk real fast, and I have this bad accent, and all that kind of stuff, and, like, people are almost afraid of you when they first approach you.
Yep.
But, I mean, again, when it comes to that, I think you're right. I think that the attitude and just all, like, that whole New York, New Jersey vibe of living there, and, you know, everybody's in a rush over there.
Yep.
You're condensed around a lot of people. There's a lot of people in a condensed area. Everybody has somewhere to go and something to do, and it's more important than what you need to do, so they need to get in front of you, and you kind of have to fight a little bit to get ahead. You know what I mean? Really? Like,
I know exactly what you mean.
I never really noticed it until I moved, and then, like, you know, when I make trips back home to Jersey, I go, wow, you know what? I know exactly when I'm getting close to Jersey because the speed alone of how I have to drive and the aggressiveness and how I have to drive goes from, like, a steady 65 to about 85 when I get into Jersey, and I have to be that much more aggressive. So
it's
I think that has something to do with it, too. I would say that definitely plays a part in you know, the style of music that probably we kind of went towards, you know?
Yeah, because, I mean, even friends that used to live here to move back to California, I see them, I see some friends from Canada or whatever, and, you know, down south, and they're always, like, kind of intimidated by me and making fun of the accent, and it's like, you know, for this area, I think I'm more or less laid back, but for out there, it's like, whoa, you know, Mr. like, hyper-aggressive, so you figure out that
plan. Yeah, it's definitely true. I've been dealing with that for the past 3 years, just being in Western PA, it's the same thing. I mean, I get accused of old, you know. He seems pissed half the time. I'm fine, dude. I don't know what to talk about. You know, I'm chilling. You know, I don't know. I don't feel pissed.
Exactly. So Blood Feast was famously known at the time as the East Coast Exodus. Now, I get the impression that stems mostly from Gary Milkovich's crazed vocals, which fall somewhere between Paul Bailoff and Ben von Stein of Exhumer. But if the band's sound came from anywhere, I'd say the music was more Slayer influenced than Exodus, particularly in terms of the wild soloing. And if they didn't debut around the same time as you guys, I'd say you were more akin to the U.S. Exhumer than any of the other comparisons. So how did you develop your sound? Who were your influences?
I mean, our influences at the time, like I said, we started playing cover songs. And I'm sure just like a million other bands out there, that's how you start. You know, you find people who are into the same kind of stuff, and then you take your favorite songs from each of these bands that you're listening to, and you play it, and then that's your influence. You know, I mean, I remember growing up, you know, drumming for me personally, my biggest three influences in drummers would have to be Rat Skates from Overkill, Rob Reiner from Anvil, Dave Lombardo from Slayer. I mean, in that progression, like, Overkill was a big thing because they were from Jersey, you know, so that influenced me as a drummer. Rob Reiner from Anvil influenced me as a drummer. And my whole style of playing, in my opinion, is pretty much surrounded Dave Lombardo. I mean, I'm a huge Slayer fan. I'm a huge Dave Lombardo fan. I think that he's probably the best metal drummer that I can give props to, simply because he's come up with that style and made it his own, and there's many, many bands that have followed it. As far as being cloned, is, you know, I remember we were always known as the East Coast answer to Slayer, pretty much is what a majority of people have said to me, and we were even promoted like that by New Renaissance. I'm going to agree with it a little bit, simply because of the speed that we used to play at. The song structuring was kind of similar. You know, the aggression was definitely there. And as far as Exodus goes, yeah, I'm going to say that was complete Gary. I mean, Gary, you know, Gary sounded like a death metal Paul Bailoff, if you will. You know what I mean? Like, I think he definitely, you know, he had those screams. He had that little guttural sound to him every once in a while. He wasn't as, not that Paul Bailoff was polished at all, but he didn't have the clarity that Paul Bailoff had. He was a little bit more dirtier than Bailoff, I think. That's how we got that comparison. But our influences, again, man, we were listening to all kinds of stuff. We were listening to Venom, Slayer, Creator, Destruction, Sodom. You know, all of that stuff was just a huge influence on us. I mean, like I said, mostly the European stuff was just a real big influence on us, and I think that's just how we got to be where we were, you know.
Right, because, I mean, you know, like I said, I always heard you guys, the East Coast Exodus, and I'm like, well, yeah, but it's really different, you know. I actually thought you guys were much more aggressive than Exodus. So, I think so, too.
I mean, like you said, I think the thing about it is we always got compared. I heard a lot of people say Dark Angel, too, you know, with the old Dark Angel. I mean, Dark Angel, I think, was more technical in their playing style. I think that we were – I like to feel that it's an honor to be compared to bands like Slayer and Exodus and stuff like that, because all that stuff was a huge influence on me, and that's how it was what I grew up listening to. But to be honest with you, I think we more kind of fall into the category comparison-wise to the European stuff, like the Creator, the Sodom, and the Destruction, and that type of stuff, I think is where I hear a little bit more comparison than the American West Coast, you know, style of thrash.
Exactly. And, you know, talking about what we were talking about earlier about the bands, it's funny because a lot of times I point out that a lot of the bands I was listening to in the middle late 80s, I'd mention the other metalheads at the time, and they'd just be clueless. Like, who? Creator? Bathory? Celtic Frost? And all that? And the whole thrash scene, except for the really big ones like Metallica, Anthrax, Megadeth, and Slayer, was pretty underground back then. And we were a relatively small and tightly knit group compared to the more mainstream metal audience. Yeah, the radio stations that play metal or have metal shows tend to keep it, like, a lot safer, stuff like Rat and Dokken. And if you remember, Headbangers Ball didn't even start making nods to the underground until they moved to Saturday nights, and the thrash stuff was always at the end of the second hour, you know, like after midnight. So basically,
I don't know if you remember. I remember getting a channel on TV called U68. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
I remember that, man. I remember seeing all kinds of crazy. I mean, I remember seeing Celtic Frost on there, Slayer videos, Exodus. Like, they used to show all kinds of, you know, great videos on there, man. It was
that was a great channel. Local, though. So I was wondering if that was like a college station or something, because But I do remember U68.
I don't even remember where that was from, and I just remember on Saturday nights, you know, I used to be in my house, and I think it was on from like 11, it was only on for like an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd watch it from 11 to 12 or 12 to 1 or whatever it was, man. But them guys just played everything underground. I mean, real underground metal. I remember seeing Voivod on there and all kinds of stuff, you know, so.
And it's funny, too, because, again, you're talking about Saturday, because what I was going to say is basically at the time, we had WMSC, Montclair State, with guys like Billsy Bub DJing, and we had Matt O'Shaughnessy's Midnight Metal, which, again, like just like the Headbangers Ball in the U68, it was all on Saturday. So, like, you were living for Saturday. But,
right.
You know, that said, Blood Feast, at least in this area, a lot of people seem to know who you were. So how big did you think that you actually got? Was this just a local thing? Or?
I think it was definitely more localized than anything else. I think just from, you know, after the record came out, like after Kill for Pleasure came out, we really, really saw a major increase in popularity in Europe. I mean, Europe really took to us. I mean, I used to be the one to do a majority of the interviews and receive all the fan mail and stuff like that. So all that stuff was at my fingertips. And I'll tell you, man, I mean, for as much recognition that we got here in the States through press and all that other kind of stuff and through fan mail and things like that, I have to say Europe was just a little bit stronger in those regards. So,
well, that was always the case.
Yeah, I mean, as far as being localized, yeah, I'm going to say that we were probably more popular on the East Coast to the Midwest than we were from the Midwest to the West Coast, definitely. I mean, I could see that just from shows that we did and from the way that the record was selling at the time and things that we were, you know, we were receiving just more radio play, we were getting more interviews, we were getting more shows all along the East Coast. We were compared to the West Coast. I mean, we've never actually played the West Coast, to be honest with you. We've never even played. Yeah, I mean, we just never.
It was probably too dirty for them, you know, because they like that clean, you know, very polished.
Yeah, I thought we were actually going to get out there actually this month because there was something going on out there that we were in talks of doing, and it turned out that it didn't happen. But as of yet, we've yet to set foot on the West Coast, West Coast ground, we shall. Yeah.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Kevin Kizmo of Blood Feast. Coming up, we discuss Kill for Pleasure and Face Fate. Title track to Kill for Pleasure. So let's talk about the music, because first and best, in my opinion, we have Kill for Pleasure, which for me, and I guess most metal fans, is your crowning moment. You know, I always really loved the cover for this one, and Face Fade as well, which may have been even more well-drawn and defined. So did you guys come up with the idea for a mascot, or was this all Drew Elliott?
Well, the actual Kill for Pleasure album cover was brought to life by our bass player, Louie. When we were in the middle of trying to come up with a cover, you know, we sat there and, you know, New Renaissance said, hey, listen, we have an artist, but feel free to, you know, if you guys know somebody that you want to do something with, that's fine. Louis came to rehearsal one day and he was like, yo, man, I had a great dream the other night about what we can possibly use for an album cover. He told us about this dream that he had, and that was pretty much it, man. It was about people being impaled on these long, long sticks. You know, there was a whole bunch of stuff going on, and we said, hey, this sounds like a pretty cool idea. And we threw it at Drew Elliott, who was the artist who was doing a majority of all the artwork for New Renaissance Band. And that's how Kill for Pleasure album cover came to be. The Face Fade album cover, we had nothing to do with that. We had no input on that cover whatsoever. As far as I can remember, the Face Fade thing was at the request of New Renaissance, meaning that we were trying to write some new songs for another album in between doing a whole bunch of stuff to promote the Kill for Pleasure record. She turned around and said, hey, listen, you guys are selling really well. I'd like to do something special. I'd like to maybe do a picture disc release. She's like, is there any other material that you guys might have? We took the song Face Fate, which was brand new at the time. We re-recorded the version of Bloodlust, because the Bloodlust song was only available on the cassette version of Kill for Pleasure, actually. It was never put on the L version in America. So a lot of people never really heard that song unless you bought the cassette. And then we just took two songs off of Kill for Pleasure and remixed them, and that's how we got the Face Fade EP. But as far as the artwork was concerned, I know that all of a sudden it just came on the table, and she was like, here's your artwork. And I think it was more her idea to try to divvy up a mascot for Blood Feast, and that's why you got that same blue kind of figure on the Face Fade EP also, you know what I mean?
I was kind of wondering if Drew just heard Gary's tortured screams on the record and came up with this guy who looks like he's in some serious existential pain. Because, you know, at least with Kill for Pleasure, you get the impression he's either one of the victims or overcome with horror at the scene. Face Fate, without any real scenario for him to be part of or reacting to, it's a lot more like Edvard Munch, you know, like a scream or a shriek against the reality of human existence or something.
Right. Like I said, we really had no input on the cover of Face Fate. That was pretty much just, it was done quickly. It was done, you know, between New Renaissance and Drew Elliott. And pretty much we just said, you know what, it looks good to us. I know you guys are in a rush to get this thing out. Let's just go ahead and do it. So that's how it wound up to be.
So let's speak to the infamous production issues on the first two releases, because Kill for Pleasure is a very intense album. You know, the sort of thing we used to put on to scare off posers and terrify the general populace back then. And yet it has some pretty bad mastering, even on the eventual CD reissue. Though I do think it sounds a lot better than the original cassette version I had back in the day. It's not as bad as like Sacrifice's Torment and Fire, but it's pretty raw. So was this related to New Renaissance and their involvement in any way? Or was it just the engineering at the studio you chose to record at?
I'll tell you, it was kind of a mix of both. And the reason I say that is simply because the deal that with New Renaissance bands was you had to pay for your own recordings, and then they would pay for the pressing and distribute it. And that was, you know, that was part of the contract. So us being as young as we were at the time and, quote-unquote, having not real jobs or anything like that, there was only so much money we can really come up with. You know, I don't even remember how much money we spent on that record, but it wasn't all that much. But the bigger problem, to be honest with you, was the studio we went to. We went to a studio which was located in Hoboken, New Jersey, called Waterfront Studios. And the reason we chose that was because we heard, first of all, it was local for us. Number two, the prices were right. And number three is, when we went there to check it out, we heard a lot of material coming out of there, and a lot of the material sounded fantastic. I mean, it sounded great. The problem was that it wasn't real, it wasn't metal, and I think that's what the big issue was. We actually got in the studio, and I remember, you know, laying down the first several tracks, and the engineer just looked at us, and he looked at us, and he literally said, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know what to do with this. You know, I mean, the only thing we were able to give him was the demo, so that was the only thing that he really heard, you know. And long story short, there was three engineers that actually worked on Kill for Pleasure. I mean, because nobody could really get the sound that we were looking for, and I think it really came down to the guys there were – great guys, great engineers, but they were not good engineers, and they did not know what to do with this type of music that we were playing.
Right.
And when it was all said and done, it was just, you know, we already invested time, we already invested money into it, and it was too late to do anything about it, so pretty much we went with it.
Yeah, because at the time, you know, metal was pretty new, at least this kind of aggressive thrash metal, so I can see
right.
that happening. I was like, because you would hear producers going, oh, this band came in, I don't know what the hell to do, I'm going to send them somewhere else.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yep, that's exactly what it was, man. It was, and actually, Lenny Kravitz was part of the owner of that studio at the time, believe it or not, too.
Oh, yeah, I was going to mention him. Okay, well, we'll get that soon. One thing I did like about the recording is the prominence of the bass drum, since you can clearly hear when you kick in any double bass phrases. And again, this is fairly early to hear in double bass, other than Except on Fast as a Shark, some Motorhead tracks, and a few thrash acts like Slayer, Dark Angel, maybe Whiplash. It was pretty rare. And I think this was
right.
all pre-Triggers, right?
Yeah, it was. There was, basically you had to come up with the sound that you were looking for from the drum itself. There was no, like going into the studio now and you can sit there and go to, you know, your Rain and Blood album and say, I want that kick drum sound, and pretty much you can get it.
Right.
No, it was messing around with microphones and adding more muffling to the bass drum and using a different kick pedal and using a different beater and taking a quarter and taping it to the bass drum head to get that click
right.
out of it. I mean, it was a lot of, you know.
Yeah, but not just the recording of it. I mean, I'm talking about the fact that you're doing double bass, and it wasn't like you're using one of these D-bass things where they kind of cheat and program and, oh, here's the trigger,
oh, yeah.
okay, and then it's going to go fast. You were doing that with your feet. That was all, you know, the real deal.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You employ a lot of turnarounds in your drumming style. It's never really straightforward or simple. You know, there's usually something interesting going on in the back end. So where did you pick all this style up? Was it really listening to Dave Lombardo and bands like that, or...?
Yeah, I mean, my style of playing, I mean, ever since I started playing drums, I was listening to stuff like Motorhead, Except, Tank, Tigers of Pantang, like all that, you know, all like the more, again, more European, Raven. I was a huge Raven fan. And when I first started playing, one of the first things that I needed to do, like I needed to do as a drummer, was to play Fast as a Shark, because at the time, when I got that record, that was the be-all, end-all of double bass drumming to me personally.
Yes.
So I was hell-bent on every minute of the day, whether I was in school or at work or whatever I was doing, my 2 feet were going every chance I had to, you know, work up the stamina to play that type of double bass. And
right.
once I heard Slayer, that was it. I mean, that's what just, I felt like if I can achieve that kind of style of drum playing, I can move on to another level, personally for me, you know what I mean?
Right.
So again, you know, my main influence in drumming style, I'm going to say, would be taken from Slayer, from Dave Lombardo. Again,
right.
earlier times, again, my three biggest influences drumming-wise, again, would have to be Rat Skates, Rob Reiner, and
right.
Dave Lombardo. Three guys are, like, my biggest influences as far as, you know, sitting down behind a drum set and trying to imitate them, you know?
And again, another positive about the production is I also like all the cavernous reverb and delay they put on Gary's vocals. There's a huge echo on there that, while it's not as clean as something like King Diamond and Abigail or Live and Leon on the Chastain albums, is very effective, and it plays right into the horror atmosphere that you're building. So it wasn't a total, like, they totally screwed this up. It was just, it had its issues. But,
yeah, I think that the good thing about the sound on Kill for Pleasure is that it's so raw. I mean,
yeah.
like it sounds like you walked into a rehearsal and pretty much heard us playing. You know, the funny thing about when you mentioned Gary's vocals is, I mean, I've been in the studio a handful of times, obviously, since Kill for Pleasure, and I don't think they do this anymore, but a lot of that quote-unquote effect that you hear on Gary's voice is not so much reverb, to be honest with you. Really what it is he laid down two vocal tracks on each song.
Oh, really?
That was something that the studio was very prominent in having us do for some reason. He would actually sing the songs twice and try to match up the vocal track two times. Deliberately, and therefore it did something for the sound of it. So a lot that you hear on Gary's voice may not be so much an effect. It may
right.
be just the simple fact of the doubling of the vocal tracks, because I know that's what we did on Kill for Pleasure.
Because I never picked that up. Usually I can hear, okay, they triple track this. Well, you know, like you listen to Randy Rose guitar solos, you can always tell when
right.
that's going on. I had no
right.
idea. I thought that was just studio reverb and, you know, maybe a little delay.
No. I mean, there was probably some of that going on, don't get me wrong, but if you're really, really, I mean, again, I remember listening to when he did the first vocal track, and you listen to it, and then he did the second vocal track, and you're like, wow, there's just something about it that sounds different and sounds almost a little weird, and it kind of gave a little bit more, I don't know what the word would be, like a little more diversity into how it sounded coming up with two vocal tracks, but I'm almost positive that's what we did, because I remember him doing it, and you know, they were like, listen, don't even be that concerned about hitting it right on the head every single time, because it was almost impossible, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, you know, to sing it the exact same way, the exact same pitch every time, so I know, but a lot of it is double-track vocals on Kill for Pleasure, so.
But even with the production overall, it's a really strong album. One of those records that I've never stopped going back to all these years. And I had periods where I was only listening to punk or goth. I had a jazz fusion period. I even had a period where I was listening to like Italian movie soundtracks from guys like Morricone and Modigliani. But always certain albums made their way to my CD player, and Kill for Pleasure was one of those. So there's something about that record that just stands out, regardless of what anybody can say about it one way or the other. The aggression, the atmosphere, and some really killer songs led to it being played a lot more often around my house anyway than anything more mainstream. And like I said before, even more so than something reasonably similar like Exodus or even Slayer. So here's a question for you. And yeah, I think you already sort of touched on this, but why Face Fate? Because it's always been referred to as an EP, but technically it's just that one new song, Face Fate. And after that, you got the re-recording of Bloodlust that didn't seem all that different except for some clearer drums, because you can really hear the double bass on that version. And both Gary's vocals and Adam Tranquilla's guitars lose a bit of that cavernous reverb and echo, which you're telling me about is the double tracking. So it's a little more in your face and a little less 80s underground feel. And I think it's also sped up a dash. So as strange as it sounds, in some ways, I actually prefer the Kill for Pleasure versions. But why that? Why did this thing come out? Was it really just, you guys are a good seller, so I just want to throw out a picture disc and...
That was pretty much it. I mean, I remember the head of the label, Ann, came to us and said, hey, listen, you know what? You guys are selling really, really well. She wanted to know where we stood as far as putting out another album and how far we were getting on it. And I said, you know, I remember saying, listen, we have probably just maybe a handful of songs, if that we've been working on for a while, and we really don't have anything definitive yet to where it would be album worthy, we feel.
Right.
And she said, hey, listen, you know what? She said, for the label's sake, she said, I really want to do a picture disc. She said, we've yet to do a picture disc, and I would really like to do it with you guys, she said, because you guys are selling really well. And, she said, I think it would be a cool collectible for the fans to have. She said, I think picture disc, you know, she only made so many of them and stuff like that. So she was like, if we can maybe do something to, you know, not just put out a picture disc, maybe, you know, to have something else on it that's new would be beneficial. You know, like I said before, we felt that Face Fate, we felt good about the song Face Fate itself, so we decided to record that. The re-recording of Bloodlust really just came to be simply because, again, it was only made available on the cassette version of Kill for Pleasure, which we didn't really know how many were selling at that point in time. And like you said, the song is played faster. We knew that we could have got it to sound a little bit better and so on and so forth. And then we just took two songs off of Kill for Pleasure that we thought, you know, that we really liked. And we just went in and tried to make them sound a little bit better for the sake of putting them out again.
Yeah, because the next question I was going to ask, why you choose those two tracks in particular to remaster?
Yeah, it was really just, we just felt like those were like some more aggressive songs, and they weren't really all that popular on Kill for Pleasure, I think. Like, what's on the EP? It's R.I.P. and
Vampire. Yeah, and I was just going to say it. They were kind of like some of the weaker tracks compared to something like, you know, Kill for Pleasure or Bloodlust.
Exactly.
You know.
And that's the reason we picked them, to be honest with you, was because we felt that what we could do with those was we can take those tracks, which are a little bit more obscure, off the record that didn't get played as much, and we can possibly give them a little bit more attention by only putting, you know, by only having those songs on a 4-song EP on a picture disc, and actually try and work with them a little bit more to make them sound a little bit better, to maybe make them a little bit more appealing, you know, to people for the way that they sounded. But the whole Face Fate thing was strictly New Renaissance's, you know, that was the label's decision on how they wanted to do it, you know.
I remember a lot of people at the time were saying, oh, you know, this was put out to show that you guys were using a new studio and you got better production, but this is what I want to say, and this is going to be a little bit of a build-up, so hang in there for a second. To my ears, there's even less of a difference with those two remix tracks that we just mentioned, you know, R.I.P. and Vampire, as opposed to the newly recorded ones, at least in terms of the CD versions, where I think they have a bit more clarity than I recall on the album and cassette versions back when. I think you gain a little clarity in the instruments, like I was saying, but lose a dash of the atmosphere. And if anything, it makes you guys sound a little crazier because you hear how close to the edge of the bar you're teetering. You know, the aggression and speed, particularly for the era this stuff was recorded in, was quite intense. But the changes, to my ears, they're pretty subtle overall. You know, I didn't notice any marked improvement in production quality between the album and the EP. So why did this come out in terms of, okay, let's go and re-record this stuff? And why was it considered an EP rather than just, you know, a single picture disc?
Well, an EP is an extended play. So right. Obviously, if you have anywhere from three or I think it's up to five tracks or something like that, they consider right. it an EP back in the day. So, that, I mean, you know, putting it out as an EP picture disc, again, that was just something that the label wanted to do.
Right.
As far as the recording quality, we actually went to the same studio again. We went back to Waterfront. And this time what we did was we actually took one of the three engineers that worked on Kills for Pleasure with us, this guy named Ray DeLeo.
Right.
He came from a punk background, and he was kind of the newer guy in that studio at the time who really didn't have that much say in what was going on over there. But we felt that he kind of knew what we were looking for.
Right.
When we went back, there were, I don't remember what songs it were, but I mean, you know, we recorded Kill for Pleasure very sporadically. You know, we had 3 days, and then we wouldn't go back in for another week, and then we'd do another 3 days. And whatever the songs Ray worked on, they just had a different feel to them, to us. You know, they had
right.
a little bit more, there was just something about the way he recorded us and the way that he worked
yeah,
with
I
us
actually,
and the way that he mixed it, that
I did
some of the songs
a difference
kind of
in the mix.
Others.
I did notice
right.
the difference in the mix across that album. It wasn't consistent necessarily. I mean,
right.
overall, but...
Right. Well, the reason for that is, again, like I said, you had three different heads, you know, three different hands of three different people, you know, working the board to try to get to what we were looking for. And
right.
when it all was said and done, we felt that Ray was the guy that we, you know, felt the most comfortable with.
Right.
And we felt that if we could get him to be the only person that we work with, we might have a good opportunity of coming out of there sounding, you know, better than what we originally did. So that's
right.
what we did. We went back to Waterfront, and we worked with Ray exclusively on those four tracks.
Right.
Now, I disagree with you. I think the recording quality of Face Fate and Bloodlust is far superior than the recording quality on Kill for Pleasure. I mean, I think it's far superior.
It's much more clear. You know, you got a lot more clarity to it,
Correct.
And it's more in your face. But it loses
Correct.
Some of that atmosphere, that cavernous thing that was happening, maybe because of the vocals,
right.
maybe because of who knows what.
Well, yeah,
and that's what I'm saying.
We recorded it differently. There was no doubling of the vocals. You know, like you said, everything was a little bit more dry. It didn't have that – I know what you're saying. It didn't have that atmosphere that Kill for Pleasure
right.
had. And you know what? To be honest with you, that – the Face Fate EP, especially those two re-recorded songs, was what we really wanted to sound like on Kill for Pleasure, to be honest.
Right.
Yeah, from the beginning. We wanted to be a little bit more, you know, we wanted to have a little bit more clarity. We wanted it to sound a little bit more powerful. You know, the atmosphere thing was not something that we intentionally did on Kill for Pleasure. That's just how it came out.
Right.
And then when we went into, you know, when we remixed the two other tracks, again, we took away the doubling of the vocals. We got everything to sound a little bit more clear. We got
right,
it to sound
definitely.
A little more clarity. But Face Fate and Bloodlust was actually, you know, brand new recordings, and the
right.
other two were just remixes. So I agree with you on the remix stuff. It doesn't really sound all that much different. Again, it sounds a little bit more powerful. It sounds a little bit – it has a little bit more clarity to it. I think you can hear the instruments a little bit
right.
better. However, it did lose the atmosphere to it. I agree with you on that.
Right.
But as far as the song Face Fate and the song Bloodlust on that.
Oh, yeah. No, I hear a difference there.
Yeah, I mean, that to me was what we were trying to achieve in the first place when we went in to do Kill for Pleasure, and
right.
it just didn't happen. You know, we
right.
got – I mean, we were still happy with it, don't get me wrong, but comparing the two to my ears and remembering how we wanted to represent ourselves on a recording –
Right.
The Face Fate EP for those two newly recorded songs were pretty much, that's where we wanted to be.
Right.
You know, that was definitely intentional. And as far as the remixes go, they're remixes. I mean, you know,
yeah.
once you record something, there's only so much you can do
you
with,
can deal with it,
what
right.
you have on. Yeah, there's only so much you can do with it. So, you know, we were just trying to make it sound a little bit better and give it a little bit more clarity and actually try to make it sound a little bit more powerful and
right.
a little bit more in your face, because that's all you can
right.
really do with it. You
know? Now, I understand this EP actually sold better than the album. So any ideas why this may have been?
You know what? I don't know. I can't even tell you what sold what, because we have had so many issues with New Renaissance as far as them giving us information in regards to how many copies we've ever sold.
Right.
Till this day, I'm never really going to know what we sold. It's just never going to happen.
Right.
I mean, the last time I was told, and this is going back, you know, after several months that Kill for Pleasure was out, she said we were doing like 10,000 copies plus of Kill for
right.
Pleasure, which at the time was phenomenal for a band called Blood Feast from New Jersey
right.
that, you know, nobody heard of, you know what I mean? So, you know, we were thrilled about that. But I couldn't tell you. I don't know. I mean, if you're telling me Face Fade sold more than Kill for Pleasure, that's news to me, and you must know something I don't then, because I don't know where it stands as far as sales go. I really don't.
Yeah, you know, it's only what you read. That's all I know from. But I have
right.
the version of Kill for Pleasure that came out on CD from New Renaissance around 99 with all the tracks listed wrong. In terms of track lists, it's a real jumble, and it's really frustrating when you're looking for a specific song. I think it's because they actually copied the record cover, so, you know, Bloodlust isn't
okay.
listed on there, even though it's in the middle of the album.
Correct.
So,
correct,
but
right, right.
There was also one version on Shark Records that I understand was a double with Kublai Khan, similarly Excellent Annihilation.
Correct.
But to my
yep.
awareness, neither of those included Face Fate. And given the space capacity of CD, you know, there's no real reason for that. So why do you think she kept it as a standalone CD, even when it went CD, I'm talking, rather than being tagged onto the reissue of Kill for Pleasure? Because, you know, the merits of the material on its great cover aside, it's pretty short.
I think the reason being is because it's just another product that she's able to promote, to be honest
okay.
with you. I know from just speaking to her and from her theory of being a record label owner that product, having product and having a certain amount of product out is important to her. So
right.
rather than taking the Face Fade EP and, you know, when she did the reissues of Kill for Pleasure and stuff like that, just putting the Face Fade EP on there,
right.
You know, she would prefer to have it as another piece of product that New Renaissance has in their catalog.
Right.
And that's pretty much what it comes down to.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Kevin Kuzma of Blood Feast. Coming up, we discuss New Renaissance and Craze Records, Chopping Block Blues, and the breakup of the band. Coming on Third Eye Cinema. Another one from Blood Feast, off Kill for Pleasure. This is The Evil. So you already kind of touched on this, but tell us a little about your experience with New Renaissance and working with Anne Boleyn, because the label had, particularly at the time, a pretty bad reputation. Not only was it set up as a sort of vanity label for her and her band Hellion, but the prevailing opinion was, and I'm quoting this, so it's not my opinion, that label with a bunch of crappy thrash acts. And yet, they
right.
did have some really good bands and albums. You know, you got you guys, you got Dream Death, you got Kublai Khan, they had At War. And although I recall some contemporaneous interviews with Anne Boleyn, where she mentioned not really caring for thrash acts like Blood Feast, these days she's come out in praise of your drumming in particular. And I also understand that you were considered New Renaissance Records' number one selling act. Now,
correct.
I know you'd mentioned having some issues in the past getting royalties out of her, and I heard some real horror stories from Dream Death as well. So shed some light on this whole aspect. What was the reality of the situation here?
Basically, the reality was this. I mean, you know, we were young. We were hungry to put a record out. And our stance with New Renaissance in the beginning was this. You know, they were one of the few labels that responded to us right from the beginning.
Right.
That seemed to be impressed with what we were doing as a band. You know, when you have that kind of support, it's a good feeling. It's something that you look towards. The way we looked at it was this. New Renaissance was a very small label at the time.
Right.
Didn't have a whole hell of a lot of acts. We
right.
looked at it as an opportunity to, you know, what we said to ourselves was this. We said, look, we can sit around and wait here for, you know, a Roadrunner to get back to us, to a Metal Blade to get back to us, to whoever else, you know, the bigger labels at the time to get back to us. However,
right.
those labels have 30, 40, 50 acts on their label.
Right.
And you know what? It's easy to get lost in the shuffle of all that. Whereas
right.
a label like the Renaissance only has a handful of acts on their label, we could possibly be the guys to come on the label and shine and be noticed on this label because there's not a lot of other things going on with this label, and they don't have 25, 30, 40 acts, and they're not, you know, you're not getting smothered by all these other artists. So to us, it was an opportunity that we looked at like that, and that's one of the big reasons we chose to go with New Renaissance. When it was all said and done, you know, the biggest problem with New Renaissance was we could just never get any type of real support from them, you know,
right.
meaning that, like, you know, she never really, she didn't have a lot of funding to do a lot of different things. She didn't have a lot of resources for promoting the records and stuff like that. As far as sales go, we could never get definitive figures from her. We could never really get royalties from her. It was just a one big bad snowball effect after another dealing with New Renaissance. And then, just like you said, people within the industry, people in the press started, you know, getting wind of what was going on and having to deal with New Renaissance themselves for whatever reason, whether it be media people or distributors or whatever the case was. You know, more
right.
and more people started having bad issues and bad experiences with working with New Renaissance Records. And it was just it was like a double-edged sword. It was kind of like, okay, listen, if it wasn't for New Renaissance Records, we would not be, I think, where we are today as far as
right.
popularity, getting music out there and so on and so forth, which I'm grateful for.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, we definitely did not get a fair deal. We definitely did not receive royalties. We definitely
right.
didn't get the information that we should have been getting all along as far as sales goes. And we didn't get the support that we needed for us to really move on to the next level to be able to do things like a real tour and go to Europe and do things and so on and so forth, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's pretty much it.
I agree with you because my feeling about it is that, you know, they did put these acts out and they did manage to get them at least on the kind of radio that I was listening to. And,
right.
you know, because you had other bands on there that you liked, it's like, okay, I like Blood Feast, let me check out Dream Death. I like both of those guys, let me check out At War, you know, whatever it was, that, you know, you were getting exposure and, you know, I liked the label. But then I started hearing all these stories and, you know, it's like, well, I don't know what to think now, you know, maybe it wasn't so good. That's why I wanted to see what's the perspective of the guys that are actually dealing with this firsthand as opposed to, you know, me being on the outside and just picking up the records and reading stuff.
Right. It, again, like you said, it's one of those things where it was a double-edged sword. I mean, there was no way to, you know, I'm happy about getting our music out there. And like you said, they, you know what, they were able to promote us to a certain degree and to get us to popularity where we are today and so on and so forth. But they were not the type of label that was able to take any of their bands and bring them to the next level
right.
where the band could have gone. You know what I mean? And that's like the really disappointing part of it. You know,
okay.
it's just one of those things.
Now, Chopping Block Blues, What happened with New Renaissance at this point? Because I've seen some interviews with Anne where she was saying that she was somehow involved with production on the album, and yet it was released with something of an abbreviated lineup on Colossal Records, a label I wasn't familiar with, but which Encyclopedia Metallum was just putting out only one other album beyond yours. And I heard that Colossal may have been New Renaissance under a different name. So what was the story behind this one, and what happened to Adam Tranquilli?
Okay, well, we recorded an actual version of Chopping Block Blues prior to the one that came out.
Okay.
And that one actually has Adam on it. Things were not working out with Adam on a personal level with the band, and therefore we decided to part separate ways with him. For the simple fact that he was on this recording, we actually decided to go in and re-record the entire album without Adam on it and do a few things to the songs that were written. Mike wrote a few songs that we decided to use and so on and so forth.
Right.
So I don't really know the story about Colossal at the time, to be honest with you. I just don't recall. I remember that I think it was some kind of partnership she had or some kind of distro deal with Colossal. I don't recall exactly how the whole Colossal name got brought into the whole aspect of New Renaissance, but it was maybe something that she worked out a deal where it was going to be an affiliate label or an affiliate type of distribution or something like that along those
right.
lines. I really don't recall at this point, but yeah, it came out on Colossal. That record was actually recorded in like 3 different studios. It was insane. We had the worst luck trying to record Chopping Block Blues, and Anne actually came all the way out to Jersey because she was like, what the hell is going on here? Because we kept switching studios.
Right.
We kept asking her for more money to record. And she was like, listen, I got to come out to the East Coast anyway for something. I'm stopping by to figure out what the hell is going on here. One studio we used actually went bankrupt in the middle of our recording. They had to close and shut the doors.
Did you get your tapes back?
We went back. I'm sorry?
Did you get your tapes back when they closed up?
Yeah. We got the tapes and everything like that. And then we went to another studio, which was located in Montclair, New Jersey, which is where we actually finished the recording.
Right.
And prior to that, the one that was recorded before the one that came out was actually
right.
done at Waterfront again.
So do you...
I'll give her this. She did spend some money on the recording of Chopping Block Blues for us because she did pay for the recording of that album, which was nice, you know?
You actually brought another question to mind here from something you said. Did you actually record these things, like, as a band live in the studio altogether? Or, you know, because I'm wondering why you didn't just remove Adam's guitar tracks if you were doing them separately.
No, what we did was we always did everything track by track. I mean, basically, the drums get recorded first. It's a guitar scratch track, and then the guitarists come in and do that. The big issue was that the record was, from my understanding, it was already done. And
right.
we had songs that we didn't use at the time that Mike wrote, and again, my mind is kind of, you know, lost in all this because it's been so long, but
right.
from my recollection, from what I can remember is, you know, we just wanted to go in and just re-record everything for the simple fact of not having Adam on the recording, not using some of his material,
right.
all that kind of stuff played into the factor of why we wanted to go in and just redo it. Plus, again, we thought that we probably could have made it sound better if we went to a different studio than what we walked out of with at Waterfront again. You know,
right.
So that was the story.
So did you end up recouping all these costs, or did it all just go right back into the label because you had to record this thing twice?
We didn't see a dime from this. I mean, we didn't see a dime. I mean, you know, the thing about it is this, you know, when it comes to Chopping Block Blues, I give her all the credit in the world because, you know what, she did pay for it. There was a lot of issues with it, and she did spend some money on it, unlike she
right.
did with recording of Face Fate and Kill for Pleasure, which we both paid for, you know,
right.
the band paid for ourselves. However, we were not receiving royalties prior to Chopping Block Blues, so it was easy to turn around for her and say, hey, look, I dropped X amount of dollars into Chopping Block Blues. I need to recoup my money first. And that's
right.
fine and well, and I agree with that 100%.
Right.
However, what happened to the royalties from Kill for Pleasure all
Pleasure,
this time?
Face
what
Fate,
happened
right.
to the royalties of Face Fate all this time? Where did all that money go? Where did,
right.
you know, and when you questioned the label about this, you know, she pointed the blame at the distributors. The distributors didn't have the money to pay her. Some of the distributors went out of business, which I know is true.
Right.
It was just, I'll tell you, man, it was just a snowball effect of bad business between New Renaissance and a lot of other people that she was dealing with.
Right.
Which in turn affected the bands on the label. I mean, that's, in my opinion,
right.
that's really what it came down to. It was just, you know, bad business decisions on her part, on other people's part, the distributors and everything that were dealing with her, and one thing led to another, and, you know, it was just a bad turnout for the bands that were on the label, you know?
Right. Now, I also understand that the original title of the album is what you used for Remnants, in other words, The Last Remains. So did you have a presentiment that this was going to be it for Blood Feast? Because at this point, you broke up the band. And I was wondering, was it the twin onslaught of death metal, killing thrash, and grunge-killing metal per se that put the final nail on the coffin, or was there something else playing into this?
Well, the name of the album was originally going to be called Heaven's Holocaust. It had nothing to do with being called The Last Remains. Yeah, the original title to Chopping Block Blues was going to be called Heaven's Holocaust. We actually had a painting already done for the cover. We had everything done. It was all ready to go. Again, been some time, so I don't recall why we wound up changing the name of it to Chopping Block Blues. I think it was more of a tongue-in-cheek type thing that we were just trying to get across, but originally it was going to be called Heaven's Holocaust.
Okay.
As far as the demise of the band, originally what happened was Mike bowed out first, and we replaced Mike with another Mike. His name was Michael Frank, who only did a handful of shows with us, and we never actually got to do any recording with him. After that, Gary decided to leave. After Gary left, we did replace him with another vocalist, and we were working on new material. The reason for their two departures, to be honest with you, was the simple fact of outright frustration. I mean, to be honest with you, we were at a point where we had a bunch of opportunities on the table. We really couldn't take advantage of any of these opportunities because we either didn't have funds to do what we needed to do with it. Some people didn't even want to work with us because we were on New Renaissance Records. Like, they were just like, listen, we've had bad circumstances with this label, and previously we feel it is better. We don't want to move forward with you guys. And I think the frustration level is, you know, we were at a point where we were like, look, we need to go to this next level in order to do something here. And you know what? Four or five guys just pulling money out of their pocket to do stuff, you're only going to get so far. You can only get so far at that point. And unfortunately, we just could not get any kind of financial support from the label to do anything further, and I think that the frustration got to Mike and it got to Gary before it just got to myself and Louie. And something that a lot of people probably don't know is we worked with Mike and this other singer. His name was Tommy, and we had probably close to an album's worth of new material done. And I don't know if you remember a label out of Canada called Craze Records.
Yes, I do, actually.
Okay. Craze Records actually offered us a really, really nice contract. And they had some guys come down from the New York office, and they came to our rehearsal studio, and they heard the new songs, and they gave us a contract. I mean, it was a beautiful contract. I mean, it was for like five albums, one live album, you know, everything was going to be paid for. I mean, it was a beautiful contract.
Right.
We were in negotiations, working a few other things out here and there for the contract, and the label went bankrupt. It just closed.
Oh. Yep.
So it was kind of like a black cloud was just following us, you know?
Right.
And after that happened, you know, it put a lot of doubt in my mind. It put a lot of doubt in Louie's mind. Louie decided to leave after that. And then we just went our separate ways at that point. You know, that was like the final nail in the coffin. After that, that whole contract thing went kablooey with Craze. We just felt like, you know what? This is just not meant to be. We're just not meant to go to the next level and do this. And it was real frustrating. It was real disappointing. And, you know, I think it just got to everybody.
Well, backtracking half a step, just to talk about the album itself, you know, this album was far more, dare I say, a polished and mainstream than either Kill for Pleasure or Face Fate. And some fans really loved the change, but it just didn't sound like what I'd come to associate with Blood Feast. You know, there was a big change there. Gary wasn't shrieking like he used to. The production was very clean by comparison. And notice how it's become something of a bad thing. Before, we're talking about how bad the production was, and that's like, that's too good. But the guitars had slowed down a bit. You know, they were far more chunky. Well, it certainly fits in well with the sort of records bands like Sepultura or Infernal Majesty were putting out at that time. Something felt kind of off. So what was your feeling about this big stylistic change?
Really what it was the influences that we were having at the time. I mean, Mike, for instance, you know, Mike Bazin had a wide range of influences. He had a lot more influences in his style of playing than we ever did, meaning myself or Adam or Louie or anybody. And Mike was really the type of guy who was very influential on other people. So he would come in and he would be listening to all these other kind of bands that we really weren't listening to at the time and so on and so forth. And his style was just a lot different than Adam's. I mean, if you really think about it, you know, Adam had a big role in writing on Kill for Pleasure. I mean, he wrote probably 80% of that.
Right.
And, you know, Mike had just a completely different style than Adam had. His style was a little bit more polished. It was a little bit more technical. You know, it was a little bit more clean. I mean, just his overall guitar sound in general compared to Adam's was.
Right.
And I think, again, you know, at the time we were listening to more West Coast stuff. We were listening to more stuff like Testament, and we were really listening to X, and we were, you know, we were more in the mode of that kind of stuff when we actually sat down to write, you know, music at that point in time, and all those influences between
played
what Mike was bringing to the table and just our ears going to different things and what they were, you know, when we were doing Kills for Pleasure, just kind of came out in the style of writing that we did for that record.
Right.
I'm not a big fan of Chopping Block. I mean, there's some songs on there that I really love that I think are great. There's other songs on there that, like, I really have, you know, I'm like, wow, you know what, if it was up to me, I would have changed this or I would have done that different or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the time, it seemed like it kind of flowed, you know. I don't know, you know, like I said, it was just one of those things where, you know, it was a different time, it was a different kind of influence that we were having. You know, Mike was the prominent songwriter at the time for that record, so you just had a lot of little changes going on within the band itself, and that's how it came out on tape, you know.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Kevin Kuzma of Blood Thieves. Coming up, we discuss Anunnaki and the Return of the Thieves. And we're on Third Eye Cinema. Here's Blood Feast with Menacing Thunder. So more than a full decade after this, Bloodfeast reappears on your own label, Militia, with Remnants of the Last Remains. And it almost sounded like from that title that you were cleaning out the closet. Like, here, this is all I got. Take it. So what prompted this?
You know what? To be honest with you, fans, it had nothing else to do with anything except for people throughout the years contacting me and saying, I'd love to get a hold of your demo. You know, do you guys have any other recordings? You know, right. I mean, from the time that the band kind of split up and went our own separate ways, there was always this contact of people where it was so funny because at least once a year, I go through it every single year, that for several months at a clip, I get bombarded with people wanting to buy merchandise, wanting to get a hold of our demo, wanting to know if we want to do shows, you know. And it was going on for literally years.
Right.
And I said to myself, man, you know what? I can't believe that there's people out there who are still interested and who still want something more from Bloodfeast, you know?
Yeah.
So I took it upon myself to just say, listen, you know what? Just to appease everybody that's been asking, let me just put something together of everything that I possibly could get my hands on and have and make it into a nice little package, a nice little compilation piece, and, you know, get it out there to satisfy the diehard people who are looking for it. That's
right.
Pretty much it. We got Kill for Pleasure shirts. We have logo shirts. I'm in the process of doing a Face Fate shirt, which should be available, like, next week. So, yeah, we've always had merchandise available and stuff. I mean, that's what I said. Like, every year, for several months out of the year, I usually get bombarded. It usually happens all at once with, like, a lot of people contacting me for one reason or another, whether it be merchandise or CDs or whatever. So
you've got the Bloodlust Suicidal Mission demo on here, two pre-production tracks from Kill for Pleasure, and a few unreleased tracks. I'm guessing that all of them except for Holocaust hail from the Chopping Block Blues era?
Right.
So what was the story behind Holocaust? Because it sounds pretty much just as strong as Face Fate. So I would have thought it would either have wound up on that or deserved a release before this.
It, you know what? It wasn't written at the time we did Face Fate.
Okay.
So, you know, that was one of those songs that after everything was all said and done and we had nothing else to do but concentrate on writing new material for another album,
right,
that came to be. And again, I think that song was actually written by Mike. You know, like I said, at the time, it's trying to recreate Kill for Pleasure is probably, it's far-fetched. You know what
right.
I mean? I mean, you hear bands say it all the time. Slayer sits there and says, listen, we can never recreate Rain and Blood. And from a musician's point of view, I can understand that because, you know what, you constantly change, you constantly want
right.
to perfect, constantly want to grow as a musician. And when you feel that you're just doing the same thing over and over and over again, you feel like you're not achieving anything. You feel that you're not progressing. You feel that you're not,
right.
you know, moving forward, you know, so... But, yeah, those songs on the Remnant CD are pretty much, just like you said, leftovers from, you know, there's some demo tracks on there from Kill for Pleasure. The demo's on there itself. And you have songs that, you know, never made it on to Chopping Block Blues because those were the versions that were recorded prior to the version you hear now of what's called Chopping Block Blues, which would involve
right.
Evan Holocaust, you know.
So for the audience, I know they're going to want to hear this one. And you sort of touched on it before. What's the Lenny Kravitz connection?
Ooh. The Lenny Kravitz connection really came down to he was recording in his first album when we went to Waterfront Studios. You know, nobody knew who Lenny Kravitz was, and Lisa Bonet, he was married to at the time.
Right.
And it just so happened that we booked time, and Lenny Kravitz was in there pretty much, I think, all night. We would come in at like 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, and this guy would still be doing vocal tracks or guitar tracks or whatever he was doing, and Lisa Bonet would be sleeping, you know, she'd be sound asleep on the couch in the recording room.
Right.
And we all know who Lisa Bonet was because I think even back at the time, she just did that big Rolling Stone cover. I mean, she was pretty popular
right.
back in the day at
right.
that point. You know, so we were doing recordings and so on and so forth, and we heard him singing. And we were doing the Kiss song, Black Diamond, and Gary obviously wasn't really a singer. You know,
right.
I mean, he wasn't about to hit all kinds of crazy notes and stuff like that. And, you know, so we went in and, you know, we heard this guy singing and, you know, they said to me, hey, Kev, you know, why don't you go talk to that dude and see if he'd be interested in maybe helping us out with, you know, this certain track and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, I went up to Lenny and I said, hey, man, you know, my name's Kevin. And we introduced each other and he's like, yeah, I heard some of your stuff. He's like, I heard you guys are doing a Kiss song and this and that. And he basically said, hey, look, you know what? He says, I love Kiss and I'm a big fan. And one thing led to another and he gave us some help and advice on that Kiss track that we did.
So I appreciated how you carried over all the tracks from the Bloodlust demo to Kill for Pleasure while adding new strong ones like, you know, the title cut and Dark Side. But as Remnants sort of confirms, it felt like there wasn't a lot of extra material in the archives from that period. And a lot of bands have songs that never make it to the studio or tracks that get dropped from the album. But it seemed like most of your music was right there on that record. So was that really everything you had and we've got it all on CD at this point?
Pretty much. I mean, pretty much you got everything that we have at our fingertips right now. I mean, there's really nothing left in the archives. I mean, there might be some other recordings here and there, demo-wise, that I didn't choose, and the only reason I didn't put them out was because of the sound quality itself. You know, it's one of those things where I probably could find a little bit more here and there. Like, I could probably find some live stuff. I could probably find more demo material. And I probably did go through it all at the time when I put the compilation together. It's just that, to my ears, these were the more prominent things that I think people would have been interested in hearing. Right. And they just sounded better than anything else that I heard at the time when I was putting it together.
Tell us a bit about Militia and what led you to start your own label. Because, once again, it's like colossal. There appears to be like two releases to your credit, which was Remnants and Anunnaki's Throne of the Anunnaki, which you also played drums on. So what challenges did you face as an independent label, and is the label still active?
The label, you know what, the label thing was really just to promote Blood Feast. I mean, when I decided to do the Militia thing, it was strictly for the simple reason of putting out the Remnants CD. I really didn't have the intention of actually trying to sign bands, although I pursued it a little bit because I said to myself, hey, if I hear a really good band, I might pursue it a little bit, but nothing really came across my table to that aspect.
Right.
So basically all I did was I really just started the label for no other reason but to promote the Blood Feast CD that I was doing. The other was when I did the Anunnaki thing with it again, it was just because I was in Anunnaki. I did have some distribution for it and so on and so forth, and instead of searching for a label and all this other stuff, just thought it would be easier to just put it out on that label and do it like that. That's how it came to be.
Now, Anunnaki is very much a death metal band with sort of black metal style vocals, somewhat akin to Killjoy's Necrophagia, but with speedy double bass drumming thrown in. So do you use triggers these days, or is it still old-school Gene Hoagland style? Because it sounds like it never lets up in some songs.
Well, I mean, when you say triggers, the thing about a trigger is, I mean, I still had to play everything on there. You're not – a trigger to me, my opinion on a trigger is getting it to sound a certain way. You're not taking a trigger and putting it in place of a physical bass drum hit that I have to hit the drums.
Right.
I mean, a trigger is just for the sound of it. So, for example – you know, everything that I've ever done, including the stuff on Anunnaki, those are my feet consistently.
Right.
Like, that's not something that, you know, he didn't take a measure of the double bass I did and then take it.
That's
and
what
just
I'm talking about, because people cheat like that nowadays. And you're like, you know, this is
because
you're going constant. Some of those tracks, it's just like, oh my God, it's like, you know, 6 minutes long, you're like, through the whole thing.
It's not any kind of cut and paste or anything like that. It basically, a trigger is just to get the type of sound that the bass drum has. So, you know, when I went into the studio, he basically said to me, hey, I have all these bass drum sounds. What one do you like and what one do you want to use for your bass drums? But
right.
I still had to play it. You know what I mean?
Right.
I sat there and I played it just like it was old school. I mean, there's no cut and pasting on my drumming or my feet or anything like that. I mean, it's what you hear is what I'm playing, you know?
Now, you actually pulled most of that band over to the Reformed Blood Feast, which was originally. Currently, you only retain John Blakars on the guitars, but somewhere between 2007 and now, you also had Carl Odenwalder on bass and even Tony Stanziano on vocals. So was it more of a casual thing where you all started jamming on Blood Feast songs and decided to restart the band?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. You know what it was? It was I tried getting the original guys back together. Nobody had any interest in doing it except for Adam.
Right.
Myself and Adam. And you know what? I didn't really. It was more of a fun thing. It was more of something to just kind of. The Blood Feast stuff is a lot easier to play than the Anunnaki stuff that I was doing. I grew up playing those songs. I knew those songs inside out. It was never an issue for me to play that kind of those songs. And it was just something to do for the fun of it.
Right.
And it was just easy for me to take the guys that I was currently playing with and try to get them to do the Blood Feast stuff. And that's pretty much how that came to be and using those people in general. Rather than trying to find a whole bunch of different people and starting a whole quote-unquote new band, it was just easier to, you know, like I said, literally take the guys I was playing with in Anunnaki and have them learn Blood Feast songs and go from there, you know, so.
But right now you have Adam Tranquilli back on guitars, and you got yourself and John from Anunnaki, and you got two new guys, Chris Natalini on vocals and Tom Lorenzo on bass. And I know that you're out there touring again, so I'm wondering if you actually have plans for new material in the works?
We are working on that right now. We are actually in the middle of working on some new stuff. Yeah, I mean, awesome. You know, when we first started doing the Blood Feast thing again and playing live, it was really because people wanted to see us. I mean,
yeah.
I kept getting requests all the time. Are you guys ever going to do shows? You know, do you think you'll ever play again? You know, will you guys ever do a Blood Feast reunion? So on and so forth. So that's how, that's the reason I started up Blood Feast again, was simply for the request of it. As far as new material goes, we are starting to finally dabble into it because we've been playing together now for a while with this lineup. And, you know, it's just, again, it's one of those things where as a musician, you kind of feel like, hey, you know what? You got that. It's in your blood, man. I can't explain it. It's just something that after a while, you know, you go, wow, I wonder what it would be like to try to come up with some, you know, some material for this band Blood Feast again and see what it sounds like and see where it goes. And so right now, you know, like I said, we're just throwing some stuff out on the table and we're kind of just playing around with it a little bit just to see, you know, where it's going to go and what it's going to sound like and that type of stuff. So, yeah, we're heading in that direction. So.
Awesome. So do you have anything you want to promote or a website you want to share with listeners?
I mean, basically we just have a, you know, we have our Facebook page, which is kept up to date. You can go to www.drinktheblood.com, which is our regular website. However, it really needs an update, which is hopefully will be done with the next week or so because I haven't touched it in quite some time.
Right.
I've just been getting carried away on Facebook. We have a Twitter account, so you can find us on Twitter at Blood Feast. I think it's Blood Feast Band or Blood Feast Official. I'm not even sure.
Yeah,
but,
I think your Facebook's Blood Feast Official.
Yeah, I think the next thing, the next show that we have coming up is going to be actually next Saturday, which is August 10th. It's going to be over in Brooklyn at the St. Vitus Bar.
Okay.
We're playing with October 31st, which is King Fowley's other band other than Deceased.
Right.
And all those guys are on the bill. There's a bunch of other bands on the bill, which I know are good because we played with some bands prior to this up-and-coming date.
Right.
And, we got some merchandise that's still available. You know, we have a handful of CDs left, and pretty much that's it, man. I mean, we're just going to, you know, hopefully in the near future start promoting some new stuff that we're going to be coming up with, and
awesome.
We'll see how it turns out.
Well, with that, Kevin, I'd like to thank you for joining me here on Third Eye Cinema, and, you know, we'd love to have you back on to discuss the new Blood Feast album when and if that comes across.
That would be great, man, and I appreciate you having me on and helping us keep the name of Blood Feast alive, man. I appreciate it, and to everybody else that supported us in any way from years ago, for the older fans, to maybe some new people that might have heard of us, come out. If you like thrash, you like old school thrash especially, come out and see us. I think that one of the strong points of Blood Feast is actually seeing us live. I think that's where we come off best, you know.
I hear that.
All right, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you again.
Yeah, all right. Take it easy.
All right. Take care.
And to close out our interview with Kevin, here's another one from Blood Feast. Stay tuned after the close for one more from the band, but right now this is one of my favorite songs from them. This is Dark Side. Contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker, you're a musician, you'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinemas@hotmail.com or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinemas. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network, Bob Paul Third Eye. Here's one final track from Blood Feast. This is the original Kill for Pleasure version of my all-time favorite Blood Feast song. Once again, this is Bloodlust. Yeah. If you missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Block Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience.